Hello and welcome to the podcast of moralapologetics.com. Our aim is to get you thinking about the moral arguments for God's existence. We think these arguments have the unique ability to both illuminate the mind and stir the heart. We're glad you're here, and we hope you enjoy the conversation. Hello and welcome to episode 10 of the podcast of moralapologetics.com. On this week's episode, we hear from Dr. Chad Thornhill regarding the doctrine of election and some of the implications for the moral argument. Certain views of the doctrine of election might pose substantial problems for the defender of the moral argument, but Dr. Thornhill explains how, when we have a biblical understanding of the doctrine, these objections can be turned back, and how a good understanding of the doctrine of election actually supports the moral argument. So, hey, Chad, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So, Chad Thornhill, I'm the chair of theological studies for Liberty University Baptist Theological Seminary, and I am an assistant professor of apologetics and biblical studies for the seminary as well.
What was your dissertation on?
My dissertation was on election, particularly looking at Paul in his Second Temple Jewish context. I'll put in a personal plug. I'm working with IVP right now, and so hopefully folks that might be interested in reading more about what I've said will be out as a book with InterVarsity sometime, hopefully next year. We're still very much in the process of that, so we don't have a date yet. But has been a really helpful and fascinating thing to me, and again, I think the implications definitely go far beyond what we've talked about here, but certainly is connected to some of these issues with, the character of God, with morality, with salvation, and so on and so forth.
But there were three particular, and I was thinking maybe we could start with this.
Okay.
There was three things that were relevant to the moral argument, mm-hmm. with election and in particular, mm-hmm. and. One was the moral performance.
Okay.
That so on certain views of election, mm-hmm. and implications for human freedom, mm-hmm. Humans don't have libertarian freedom.
Right.
And maybe we can just explain what that is.
Okay.
So you want to do that or?
Yeah.
Sure.
So yeah, the way that I see it, it's helpful sometimes starting these discussions to kind of put things along the spectrum.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
At one end, we have sort of the, and I'm assuming all of this in a theistic framework. So
right.
On one end, we have the hardline determinism, which most people, most scholars, theologians, at least today, would not at least outright claim to hold. And sort of on the other end of the spectrum, you have a radical view of human freedom, where it seems like God is actually in control of very little. And that's sort of, I think on that end of the spectrum, we're probably outside of the fringes of evangelicalism.
But those are sort of the theistic options.
Yeah, and I think probably, open theism even, I think is, it depends on who you're reading as to how they nuance it.
Yeah.
So I think more like process theology and those types of movements would be on the extreme. And again, there are variations of process theology, so part of that's not maybe fair. But they're basically, there's an extreme to which human freedom is put out as the primary thing, to the extent that it seems that God is actually in control of very little.
Right.
And then the opposite problem is if God really is in control of everything in a causal sort of way, a manner of direct causation, then when we have not only big moral atrocities like, and the Holocaust tends to stand as sort of one of the examples, but where we have these major issues within humanity that smack to us of moral failure, that raises the question, okay, did God directly cause that? And if so, then is God sort of perpetuating evil among humanity? And so in the middle, there are sort of these various iterations like compatibilism, which most people would refer to as a soft form of determinism, where God is still determining the outcomes, but he's not doing it through direct causation as much as through indirect causation. And there are varying forms of compatibilism. There's sort of the, I think Geisler's term, he talks about something like simple sovereignty in a simple sense where God is sovereign, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's mm-hmm. controlling all the details. And I don't know that he exactly tries to map out with specifics what that looks like. And then you have Molinism. And so really there's, within the question of, you know, of election and human freedom and all of that, there's sort of, there's this convergence of the different issues of God's sovereignty, human freedom, foreknowledge, and predestination. And so when people talk about election in particular, you almost have to ask, what exactly are you talking about? Because mm-hmm. In my mind, election doesn't necessarily entail all of those things. All of those things are related to it, but those are separate issues. Election isn't the same thing as predestination. And election, again, in my mind, isn't the same thing as God's sovereignty, and it isn't the same thing as human freedom. But there is definitely a range of variation as people approach the problem in different ways.
Yeah, so but one way to categorize it is like, is to have compatibilists, mm-hmm. or you could have determinists, and then compatibilists, and then libertarians.
Right.
I think most people, the guys on the end of the spectrum there today are going to be the compatibilists. Mm-hmm. I don't know of many determinists around.
Right.
But so compatibilism then is the idea that you freely choose, you're free mm-hmm. to do what you want to do.
Right.
But you can only ever do what you desire to do.
Right.
And then that, but God has determined what those desires will be. Is that?
Yeah, and it takes different shapes. So, you know, one of the ways people tend to come at it is if we think of, and where the discussion tends to center are on one of two issues: what is God's role in salvation, and what's the human role,
right.
and those same two questions as it pertains to moral activity. So, what's God's role in moral evil, and what's right. the human's role in moral evil? The way that I've seen that try to get teased out by compatibilists is something to the effect of God knows, basically, if we think of it in terms of circumstances rather than of direct causation. So God knows basically what circumstances would result in a certain outcome. So taking the example of salvation, God knows for Johnny what it would take basically for Johnny to come to faith in Christ, and thus arranges the circumstances in such a way to ensure that that happens. Where that, in my mind, raises a difficulty, and compatibilists have attempted to answer this, that raises the difficulty, and Jerry Walls, in particular, is someone who I think has tried to press them on this issue, is why wouldn't God then just arrange everyone's circumstances in a way that they freely are coming to saving faith in Jesus? And again, there are various responses to it. So the reason that I tend not to fall, I wouldn't myself fall into the compatibilist camp, is because it doesn't seem to me to eliminate the problem as much as it just puts an intervening layer into the problem. And so when you get past that intervening layer, ultimately at the root of things, it seems like the problem, which is more or less, is God the direct cause of salvation for individuals? And if so, why doesn't he directly cause it for everyone?
Right.
In this scenario, it seems God is sort of the ultimate cause, not the direct cause, but he arranges things in such a way to make that happen. And if God is arranging all circumstances, then he's also arranging circumstances, for example, to take... taking the example of the Holocaust, that would raise the question, well, did God arrange the circumstances around Hitler so as to create basically the Holocaust?
Right,
or
right.
was that, and again, the question of foreknowledge here is a separate one. It's different to say that God knew what was going to happen or knew the various things that could happen.
Right.
There are different ways that people approach that issue than to say that God, sort of set it up so that it had to happen. So the compatibilists will say that humans are genuinely free. They will only decide what they want to decide. But that freedom it seems, in that construction, occurs basically the parameters are established so that they will only decide something.
So, right. So they could not do otherwise.
It's sort of like the question of if they could do otherwise becomes irrelevant.
Right. They could not do otherwise, right.
Right. So the compatibilist, I think, would try to answer they could, but they qualify that by saying, well, if God had arranged the, you know, they could do otherwise, but that would entail that God would have had to arrange the circumstances in a different way so that they would actually do otherwise.
So for any decision that Johnny makes in that particular set of circumstances, Johnny could not have done otherwise. Is that...
That seems to me to be, the inevitable conclusion from it.
So we have this compatibilist view, and then we have the libertarian view, which, as I understand it, is the idea that persons are originators of causes in the world, and they have the power to do otherwise in at least some circumstances.
Right. 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 So by libertarians would qualify that by this we don't mean that you can do anything that you want to do just because you want to
do it. I couldn't just will to fly to the moon.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we're limited in the sense that our circumstances, if we want to use the same word, do not allow for our desires to be achieved in any and every sense of the term. But the libertarian would want to put more weight upon the actuality of human decision making, that humans truly are free agents to make decisions and then to affect outcomes.
So this is the first area that I was thinking about with election, and the moral argument is you have this question of what do we mean by human freedom, and with salvation there is a question of, well, if determinism or compatibilism is true, then how is it that I'm morally responsible for rejecting God? And another one is culpability. So I might not be able to choose to do good, which is a question of moral performance and the ability to pursue the moral life at all. And so then there's this other question of guiltiness, of how can I be responsible or held accountable for something I could not have possibly done otherwise.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I see is related here is then the character and justice of God. And I'm just kind of, I want to just kind of pose these questions in a kind of simple way, I guess, because I think that some of these might be based on mistakes, but this is just how you're going to run across these questions, right? So someone might say, well, look, if election means that who gets saved is totally up to God, then it doesn't seem like God's a very good person. Because I would think a good person would choose everyone, right? So I think that's kind of the main objection there. And you might also get this kind of objection. Well, look, you know, it doesn't seem very virtuous of God to have such meticulous control over everything.
Right.
That, a good God, like a good parent, would allow his creatures a certain amount of leeway, a certain amount of freedom. And one more thought on this is, this is just kind of the naive question here, right? Mm-hmm. But how could it be fair for God to judge us on what we believe or who we trust? Shouldn't God judge us on the basis of what we do? It doesn't seem like, it seems like an arbitrary thing to say, well, whether or not you trust in Christ is going to be what God judges you on.
Yeah.
When there are lots of good people out there who live virtuous lives, you know, you might think of Gandhi or somebody like that, who don't believe in Jesus, but yet they're not, as far as we know, they're not going to be in heaven because they didn't accept Jesus. So you have these challenges to moral performance, culpability, and the character of God. And I wonder how you could help us kind of sort through these.
Yeah, so, and this is, the first part of this is probably a much longer answer than most people want to hear. But, so as it relates specifically to election.
If you want to just go ahead too and Just take, you know, as long as you want to kind of land your view too, that's fine.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of a helpful setup for some of the subsequent questions.
Okay.
So my approach to election is, where I've tried to come at it, is looking specifically at the Jewish context of the New Testament. So folks have, I think a lot of folks have developed well what this looks like in the Old Testament. And there's been a lot of discussion, but not necessarily focus on then looking at a Second Temple Jewish context as sort of, and I've primarily focused on Paul, but I think that this works well in the Gospels and in other places as well. When we immerse ourselves in the historical situation of the New Testament and better understand what that Jewish context looks like, there are some things that pop out to us that don't otherwise pop out. And why I think this is important is because all of us are readers with baggage mm-hmm. when we come to the Bible. That baggage it comes from our worldview, it comes from our upbringing, it comes from what kind of churches we've attended. And so we read certain passages in certain ways because that's how we've been taught to read them, and that's how we've experienced them.
Right.
So when we want to get at a more contextually nuanced understanding, you know, grammar and theology and all of those things are helpful, but I think ultimately the more we can immerse ourselves in the first century mentality, the more that that's going to open up what the biblical authors were and were not talking about when they used certain terms and ideas. So in the Old Testament, when we look at the notion of election, this primarily seems to me to be focused on the idea that God has chosen to form a people, and ultimately this flows into the larger story of God righting the wrongs in the world. So that people are going to be a part in God's plan of the restoration of humanity.
Okay.
So we have God calling Abraham, and part of Abraham's call is, I'm going to make you a great nation, you're going to have lots of descendants, you're going to have a land, and through you all the nations will be blessed. We have then in the book of Exodus, this declaration that they're going to be a kingdom of priests, and how most Old Testament scholars read that is as picking up on this intent of God's people for the nations. If the nation is priests, if they're all priests in a sense, and it's clearly, I think, a figurative idea. It's not that they would all actually be, you know, working in the temple, but the idea seems to be that the nation is intended to be ministering to the other nation.
Right.
We have then in Deuteronomy different ways that this gets picked up, and this becomes sort of full-blown by the time we get to the prophets, to Isaiah in particular, who is used all over the New Testament in connection to this, where when God restores Israel, it's not just Israel, but the nations are going to come and be a part of that restoration. So when the New Testament authors, and Paul in particular, since he's the heaviest using this, pick up on this language of election, it seems to me that that background has to be significant. And we're looking at the Jewish context is helpful is because it shows us the ways in which this language was and was not being used.
So let me ask a question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So is the idea then that Israel was a nation elected as God's chosen people to minister as priests to the world?
Mm-hmm.
So then the election, would it be fair to say then that the election is for like a way to invite others into the kingdom of God? Or
yes. So there's a couple of different senses that develop through this. One, I think, is a clearly missional strain to it. And N.T. Wright, probably more than anybody, has emphasized this aspect of it, in that God's choosing wasn't simply for the benefit of Israel, but this was God's way. Wright would say probably something along the lines of, this was how God intended to right the world, to set the world at right. And ultimately, so we kind of had this, it's interesting as you kind of look at the movement. It starts with an individual, it blossoms to a nation, it shrinks to a remnant, and this is again sort of how Wright formulates it. And then it sort of comes on the pinpoint of Jesus. And so Wright sees an incredible amount of significance on Jesus as an Israelite, that God hasn't abandoned the plan, that he's actually fulfilling it. He's still fulfilling this plan through Israel, but it's specifically through a faithful Israelite.
And this is the plan, like that when God promised Abraham that he would bless the world through him.
Right.
And that's coming to fulfillment in through Israel and then ultimately through
Jesus. In Jesus. Okay. Yeah. And so that it's sort of, again, it starts narrow. It starts with a man, Abraham, blossoms to a nation, shrinks to a remnant, pinpointed on Israel, and then it re-expands. And it's not only now for Israel, but also for the whole world, for the Gentiles, for the ethnos, for the nations. And so when Paul, over and over again, and this is really one of the fascinating things about most of the places where Paul is heaviest in election language, this would be in Romans and Ephesians. There are bits of it in Colossians. There's a lot of it in Galatians. There's some of it in 1st and 2nd Corinthians. When he integrates election language, far more often than not, there is some Jew-Gentile connotation in the context. And to me, the significance of that is Paul, one of the things Paul really presses against, especially in Romans, Galatians, but again, I think it's in Ephesians and it's in other places as well, is on breaking down these barriers between Jews and Gentiles, that in particular the law and you know, Jewish observance of it, etc., would entail. And his point is because he wants the people of God to be unified, and he sees election as a way of, I think, affirming Gentile equal standing in the people of God. And so there clearly, I think, is this missional strain to it. But the other side of that is there's an ethical strain to it as well. It's not just that there's a plan working through all of this, but that these people are also supposed to look a certain way. And we see that again throughout the Old Testament with some of the terminology in the New Testament in Greek. Words that mean choice or choose can also just mean excellent, and sometimes it carries a moral connotation. So the verbiage even sort of has this double-edged idea to it. And so ultimately in the New Testament, in the Old Testament we see God intends this people to look differently. They're supposed to follow a certain standard. They're supposed to be living in a certain way where they're noticeably different from the world. And in the New Testament, I think that's still the same intent, but that again gets focused very narrowly on being in Christ and, you know, imitating more or less Jesus. So Jesus sort of becomes the standard that believers are to emulate. But again, this language is all very much tied together in these passages. There are ethical connotations, there are missional connotations. And it's not just a soteriological thing, which is usually the context in which it gets discussed. That's obviously a part of it, but it's much bigger than that. And in my mind, these passages, what I would ultimately argue is that these passages don't require what would typically be called double predestination. This idea that God has chosen some for eternal salvation and some for eternal damnation, and not chosen in terms of his foreknowledge of, you know, their response. So I think that clearly, in a sense, ties into the moral performance, because election itself sort of intends moral performance. And within Paul's writing, it's the energizing of the Spirit that really allows humans to live to the image of God as they were intended to. Okay. So I think that, you know, where I think the image of God sort of comes into this is, in my mind, believers and unbelievers alike, all are made in God's image. To me, that means all have some volitional capacities, and all also have the ability to recognize moral goods and moral evils, even if we don't recognize them in absolute or perfect ways. And that's not to say that there aren't absolutes, but that's our perception of them. And what Paul seems to indicate in places like Romans 8 and elsewhere is that it's specifically the Spirit now that sort of re-energizes what that image was supposed to look like, and is equipping believers to actually live to those moral standards that are expected of humanity. So there's a performative difference, a qualitative difference in the performance, but I don't know that without, you know, I don't think Paul would go so far to say, and he's often interpreted this way, I think, that unbelievers can't live to a certain extent morally. Mm-hmm. They can't recognize moral goods and follow through with them. The question is a qualitative one.
So if you think about the Romans 3, mm-hmm. there is none who do righteous, no, mm-hmm. not one, mm-hmm. right? Which is often brought up in support of the idea of total depravity, that the unregenerate person right. cannot do anything mm-hmm. good at all. So how would you respond to somebody saying, bringing up that point?
First of all, and again, it's exciting to me how this fits together. Romans 3:4, Jew Gentile issues. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's the same problem of disunity, and I think in my mind what Paul is doing in Romans 3, when he is trying to show that no one is righteous, that's specifically to show Gentiles are on the hook just like Jews are on the hook. Okay. So the all, I think, is very much intended to be less a anthropological declaration, though that there's an aspect to it, than an ethnic declaration. Right. This affects all humanity. Jews don't come at this any differently than Gentiles do. And, you know, one of the interesting things in teasing this out is looking at the context of all these quotations. They come from the Psalms, and obviously we don't have time to get into all the, you know, there's six or seven different Psalms that Paul quotes from here. But when we look at the Psalter, so Paul's looking at these declarations that basically seem to indicate that there's nothing that any human ever does that's good apart from God doing right. it for them. That's how it often gets interpreted. When we look at the Psalter itself, though, we also have these passages where David says things like, I'm completely blameless before you. Mm-hmm. And so I think from a genre perspective, we have to appreciate where those things are coming from. I don't think, in my mind, he's not totalizing this to say this is true of every human in every single situation. And people will say things like, even the good that humans try to do, they're doing it from evil motivations. Right. So if you bring up Gandhi or you bring up Mother Teresa or whoever, Gandhi had, you know, the argument that comes out of this is Gandhi just had selfish motivations for doing this. Right. In my mind, it's not really necessary to go there, because the main thing Paul's trying to get at here is Jews and Gentiles both have a problem with sin. And it doesn't seem to me that we have to totalize the problem to where everything humans ever do apart from God is always completely and totally sinful. That doesn't seem to me to put humans off the hook, because humans are still sinful. And ultimately, what Paul will connect in Romans is the problem of sin and the consequence of death. And this is where the resurrection, you know, ultimately becomes the solution, because it's not just sin that needs to be solved, it's also death. And so even if a person is living an okay moral life, they're still going to die. They're still not going to be
right.
empowered with this new life apart from Christ. So this is where I think sometimes people, and I'm not trying to say sin isn't a big problem, so don't hear me saying that.
Right.
But I think people sometimes over-exaggerate the problem to the extent where we end up with these weird and unnecessary exaggerations about how we define human nature. And it doesn't seem to me we have to go to that extreme in order to still recognize the problem that Paul and others are dealing with in the New Testament.
So is it? Could you say it's like this? It's Paul's not actually saying something like, "Well, the image of God is totally destroyed, so that they always do bad all the time without exception." But he's really saying that they're guilty before God mm-hmm. because of their sin, and that leads to death.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with this moral performance issue, mm-hmm. what we're saying then is that the unbeliever has a capacity to live a moral life.
Mm-hmm.
However, that will not end up in their overcoming the problem of sin and death.
Right.
And their capacity is severely limited insofar as their soul's been affected yep. by sin. And the point about election you were making is that election not only talks about salvation, mm-hmm. but about the kind of life that believers are supposed to have. Mm-hmm. That we once if we are part of the elect, we are empowered by God through His Spirit, mm-hmm. so that we can live the moral life. We can have that. We can do what we're meant to do.
Yeah.
So now I noticed too that you took there. I think you took a libertarian position on free will with when you said that the image of God includes like the power of volition.
Yeah. So and you know, image of God language is tough because in terms of defining what exactly that means, because it's not really ever defined for us in Scripture.
Right.
And the phrase occurs, you know, so scantly, but. You know, it seems to me that I like, and I forget, this isn't original with me, and I can't remember the source, but to sort of think of imaging less in terms of a noun than in terms of a verb.
Mm-hmm.
So imaging God is something that we do.
So I've heard this too, it's like a functional
right.
thing, right?
And, you know, yeah, so people will put it in different camps, functional, relational,
right.
et cetera. And I don't know that any one of those is necessarily totally right. In the ancient Near Eastern context, and I think D.J. Klein's is where a lot of this idea came from. To be an image of a god was to be an idol, basically. And the idea is that this image is representing the deity. Mm-hmm. It isn't itself the deity, but it's representing the deity. And there seems to be some sense in which in the Old Testament, humans really were intended to be representative of God. And
right.
so
like
whether
in Genesis,
that turns into, you know, to creativity, to relationship,
right. yeah.
to moral function, to volition, I think there are different aspects to what that looks like. In Genesis, that's, I think, linked more closely to the, you know, the cultivating the earth
right,
type,
right, right.
type
that's
idea.
That's what I heard, too. Yeah.
yeah. yeah. So
that they were supposed to be, the image of God refers to the humans' role of ruling and reigning in God's
right.
place on the earth.
Yeah.
Right. But until we think about this, is too, and this is, I heard this in J.P. Moreland and Scott Ray's, mm-hmm. What is it? Human, I forget the name of the title, but they were saying that even if it's just functional,
mm-hmm.
and I think this is where you're going too, even if it were just functional, that serving a certain function entails certain properties of the person.
Yeah, yeah, right? absolutely, yeah.
So if you're going to rule and reign for God on earth as his representative, you would need to have something like creativity and volition
yeah.
and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I like to really think of this. I know analogies are never perfect, but if we think of imaging again as this verbal idea and we think of it as a mirror, okay, so obviously the mirror isn't the thing that it's reflecting. There's a distinction there.
Right.
But in unbelieving humanity, if we want to call it that, And to an extent, in believing humanity, this is still true. It's a dirty mirror. Okay, so you still see the image; it's still reflecting it, but it isn't reflecting it in a clear way. And to me, that seems an apt analogy to the extent that where we recognize, just as humans in general, where we can recognize justice and injustice, and that's not to say again that these things are always black and white, but where we can recognize justice and injustice. Morality and immorality, you know, creativity, where we can recognize beauty in art and music, and these are things that humans sort of intuit, and we share as humanity in these different qualities. That seems to me to be reflective of the fact that we're made in God's image, that
okay.
these things come from God, and again, we don't reflect these things perfectly. So, to an extent, becoming a believer then is where the mirror starts to become clean, okay? And it's not completely cleaned. It's not that we instantly are living in such a way as Christ would have that it's obvious and apparent to everyone
right.
that we have this special spark of deity or something within us. But there's this process of cleaning, in my mind, that happens in the life of a believer where they now are in an intentional way and in a more faithful way reflecting the image of God by reflecting Christ himself. And we have Paul talking about Christ as God's image. And so I think that those things all end up being linked up. And so again, there's a qualitative difference. But it doesn't seem to me that we have to postulate the divide to such an extent that we end up saying something like unbelieving humanity can't ever say anything true, say anything, do anything beautiful, do anything good, ever act in any ways that are morally appropriate without some sort of, you know, ulterior underlying evil motive behind it. Because if we all truly do share in the image of God, though to varying degrees and extents, then in my mind, that's allowable, and it actually makes good sense.
Okay, so we're already with this. So then I think to kind of come back around again to the objection that was raised to moral performance, yep, and being unable to live the moral life.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you said so far kind of dismantles that, because we're saying that the image of God is the engine, you might say, that drives our ability to have a moral life, mm-hmm, and it includes the necessary conditions of having a will,
mm-hmm,
even though, but because of sin,
mm-hmm,
the unbeliever won't be able to realize the goal of the, yeah, moral life. But in election is not, in election, number one, it empowers people to live the moral life,
mm-hmm,
and number two, being elect is often talked about as including the dimensions of the moral life,
mm-hmm,
which is made possible by Spirit.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and one other thing that I think helps set this in a better context is often when Paul talks about salvation, and sometimes this is in the context of election as well, there's this idea of a transfer of dominion or a transfer of powers. And so when he says things like we are slaves to sin, we were under the elementary principles of the world. And in Romans in particular, one of the ways that he does this is he personifies sin. Sin isn't just things that we do. Sin is actually doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Paul, there are two domains. There's the domain of the world, so to speak, where all of these powers are at work. The elementary principles, he calls them, sin itself, death, where he personifies these ideas of evil and corruption and decay. And that's where death reigns, that's where sin reigns. And to put that in the terminology of being a slave or of these powers ruling, what Paul is saying is, like it or not, apart from Christ, that's the kingdom that we live in.
Right.
Okay, we're citizens there, they are our rulers, and though we have the ability as humans in general to reflect God, because of where we are, because of this domain that we live in, we can't just pull ourselves up by our moral bootstraps and all of a sudden solve our own problem. Okay, so for Paul then, and Colossians puts this very nicely. I was going to quote it, but I'm afraid I'm going to mess it up now because I'm on the spot. So I'll just flip there.
All right.
But Colossians puts this really nicely in Colossians chapter 1, verse 13. For he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son whom he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. There's a transfer of realm here that's taking place. We've gone from the kingdom ruled by these powers like sin and death and evil in general, and we've been transferred into the kingdom of the Son, and it's in that kingdom that moral thriving, so to speak, is appropriately going to take place, because we are incorporated into Christ, we participate in his life, and it's transformative in the sense then that it's described as being very qualitatively different, and the Spirit again is the thing that's empowering all of that. So it's not to say, it's not to say that the plight is not serious, because
right,
when Paul puts it in those terms, you're a slave, this is your master.
Yeah.
You know, what can you do about it? There's nothing you can do about it unless that situation is resolved. And this is why Paul uses the vocabulary of death so much to refer to salvation. You have to basically die to the kingdom that you're in so you can be transferred to the new one. And baptism, of course, is a portrayal of this when we die and we're raised to new life. When Paul talks about us walking in the newness of life and all of that, I think that image largely stands behind all of that, of this idea of two different realms. And so though humans, again, are in God's image, and I think can rightly reflect goodness and truth and beauty and morality apart from Christ, in varying ways to varying degrees. That doesn't really, in my mind, suggesting that doesn't suggest that then somehow we've eliminated this problem that the New Testament seems to be wrestling with. Because in those terminology, it's really only by dying within that kingdom and being transferred to the kingdom of Christ that any hope, any salvific, eschatological sort of transformation can actually take place.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the podcast of moralapologetics.com. If you get a chance, head on over to the website. You'll find everything from poems to essays by philosophers to posts by biblical scholars. So it's a really great resource for any questions you have about the moral argument. Thanks for listening again, and I hope to see you next week.